Welcome, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Sammy Kayola, in for Cherry Gregg. Coming up this hour, we'll hear from a James Beard Award winner on what makes a good cocktail and where to find them.
And also, I want to say, welcome, Sammy Kayola. Thanks so much for being here. We're happy to have you. I'll also mention that later in the show, we're going to talk about the rising prices at the Jersey Shore, which was once an affordable vacation destination for many in our area. And we want to hear from you in that segment. Did you have to ditch the shore because it got too pricey? Maybe you think this is all blown out of proportion and we're merely inflating the narrative here. So give us a call. Our number is 888-477-9499, or you can email studio2@whyy.org. But first, Sammy, I'm going to welcome you into this tradition. We're going to talk about some news that's in the headlines. What do you got for us?
Thanks, Avi. Today we have a story about Philly bar culture, specifically which bars you can smoke in. Philadelphia is the largest city that still allows smoking inside just a few establishments.
Just a few.
This comes from Ali Mohsin up at Billy Penn. He looked into this ban on indoor smoking that happened in 2008, but there were exemptions, and a couple of bars applied in this small window, and they're now allowed to have smoking inside. Some restaurants and bars say they lost customers as a result of that ban because patrons wanted to go elsewhere, and they could if they wanted to smoke inside. And some said they really saw a change in clientele, people who wanted to breathe clean air inside the bar.
That would be me, by the way.
Yeah, many people like the change, but many people really like that kind of gritty, smoky, hazy Philly bar that some of us have been in. And, you know, smoking in Philly, it used to be higher than the national average. We were 7 points above the rest of the U.S. in 2008, with 27% of people smoking. And since then, there's been a decline. A little under 1 in 5 Philadelphians smoke now. That's according to the City Health Department's 2020 numbers.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. And first of all, I'll direct you again to BillyPenn.com if you want to read more about it. There are some great quotes in there because they're talking to bartenders at various bars around Philly, including some of these few that still allow smoking inside. And the upshot is that this is going to die out because the way that this regulation is structured, these few people are grandfathered in, but you cannot transfer your grandfathering to anyone else, even within your own family. So you own one of these bars. If you don't want to own it anymore, you pass away. The next person who owns the bar, even if they're your blood and kin, they don't get the privilege of allowing smoking in the establishment. So over time, we will dwindle down to zero of these bars in Philadelphia.
Right. This basically dies out with the ownership. And these exemptions don't exist anymore. This was a limited time offer. There aren't going to be new applications for exemptions. So it's certainly the end of an era.
It will be. It's a slow end of an era. And I thought about this a long time ago. If there's two things, like let's say I live to be 90 years old, Sammy, God willing.
I hope that for you, Abby.
Thank you so much. And if I live to be 90 years old and I'm having like a back in my day lecture to like my grandkids or some young whippersnappers, I think I'm going to bring up two things that are going to blow their mind. One is dial-up internet. That's going to blow their mind. And the second is the fact that when I was young, there used to be a smoking section in like every restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that doesn't exist anymore. And by that time, there'll be like no establishments where you could smoke at all. No all smoking, no non-smoking, no smoking section. So it's just one of those things that's filtering out of our culture.
Uh-huh.
All right, let's move to another story now that I've made a terrible joke. So we learned in the Inquirer recently that it is likely that children in the School District of Philadelphia will soon get mandatory lessons on the significance of Juneteenth. That will likely be implemented in the 23-24 school year. It still has to be approved by the board, but it's likely that's going to be part of the curriculum K-12 moving forward in the School District of Philadelphia. They're going to have lessons about Juneteenth, which, if you don't know, was celebrated yesterday. It marks the occasion that enslaved people in Galveston, Texas, learned that they were free. That was June 19th, 1865. It's been a federal holiday since 2021.
Yeah, it's a fairly new holiday.
It's a very new holiday.
People are still getting on board with, oh, what is this? And what do we need to learn about it? What do we need to teach our kids about it? So
yeah.
It's
like, how do we mark this? And I think everyone's sort of figuring out the best way to do it themselves. And I will point out, by the way, that the School District of Philadelphia was the first major school district in the country to mandate that everyone take an African-American history course before graduation. That was back in 2005. So the school district's been thinking about these types of issues for a while, has been a leader on these types of issues for a while. So now they're sort of expanding that with this Juneteenth mandate. So it'll be interesting to see how it pans out.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to quickly jump into some environmental news here.
Sure.
Wind farms are making headlines in New Jersey and in Delaware. So three groups made up of New Jersey residents are suing the state over a wind farm project. These groups are called Save Long Beach Island, Defend Brigantine Beach, and Protect Our Coast, New Jersey. They filed an appeal on Friday. This is after the Superior Court of New Jersey actually already determined in April that this project is consistent with the state coastal management rules, but these groups are now filing an appeal. This project is called Ocean Wind 1, and it would put 98 turbines, approximately 13 nautical miles offshore from Atlantic City and Ocean City. And, you know, we checked it out earlier, and some of these projections, you can kind of see the turbines way off in the distance.
Little dots out on the horizon.
Yeah, way out there. But these groups they're concerned about marine life. They're concerned about migration corridors for endangered marine mammals, and they've been, you know, pushing the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection to do something about this, to slow this process. Now, the former head of the DEP says that there have been numerous environmental studies regarding offshore wind, and really the bigger threat here is the climate crisis, and that we need wind turbines to lessen our reliance on fossil fuels.
Right.
It's sort of this, you know, this debate almost between environmental groups about, you know, what's the necessary evil and, you know, how do we mitigate maybe some of this damage to marine life. So it's an interesting debate. And there's a similar debate happening down in Delaware. In 2017, Delaware Governor John Carney, who's a supporter of offshore wind, actually established a working group to study this topic. And they recommended the state not move forward with it, but actually just because of financial reasons for it being too costly.
Yeah. And so the development now in Delaware, right, is that there was a bill to study this further, to sort of revive Delaware's potential building out of wind farms and wind energy along the state's coastline. So if you get a sense of New Jersey has been doing this for a while and they're still tied up in the courts. So if Delaware's sort of just tiptoeing now, you would imagine it's going to be a while before you see any big spinning things off the coast of Delaware. But it's just something to look for. And I'll just plug this. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk with an expert who looks at how we as a globe can get to net zero carbon emissions, which means, hey, we're not putting out any more carbon emissions than I suppose we're capturing in some way. And it's very complicated. You try to game it out. There are so many considerations. And, you know, this is one tiny part of that equation. You know, the fights in New Jersey and Delaware and coastal communities all across the world about wind farms. So it's just, we're gonna blow the magnifying glass way out tomorrow, and we're gonna look at this from a bigger perspective. So stay tuned for that. Also, I want to mention something that's going on today at Philly's Love Park. It's called Welcome America, which is an event celebrating World Refugee Day. I will point out WHYY is part of this event. The UN estimates there are 35 million refugees worldwide. That number has spiked recently with conflicts in Afghanistan, Syria, Ukraine, and elsewhere. So this is really an especially apt time to talk about the global refugee crisis and its connection to our region. So here in Studio 2, right across from me, we have Rosalind Holtzman, who is sponsoring two Ukrainian refugees now living here in Philadelphia. First of all, Rosalind, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my experience.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, Sammy, start us off here.
Yeah, we're happy to have you. Let's start with the basics. What does it mean to sponsor two Ukrainian refugees? What is that process, and how did you get into it?
There's a program that the Biden administration enacted called Uniting for Ukraine. And it allows Ukrainians to apply to come here and to have temporary legal status for 2 years with work authorization so that they can become self-supporting. It is temporary, for people who are part of a sponsorship, the other part is that you agree to be financially responsible for a period of 6 months, the initial period of 6 months. And that is a requirement in order to be able to get into the country, that you will vouch that you will support them. They will not be, as they say, a public charge.
And how did you get involved, and why did you decide to step up and sponsor?
Someone in my community told me about it, and I was intrigued. I wanted to consider it. So I spoke with the woman who was spearheading it. Her name is Allison. She's also participating in the festivities today. And talked about it and decided I wanted to go ahead. This is particularly important to me because my family has Ukrainian roots. Although the story goes back over 100 years, my grandparents fled Ukraine. They were Ukrainian Jews. There were also Polish Jews in my family, and they came here seeking refuge and safety. Mm. My grandmother and her husband, my grandmother Celia, her husband Max, were able to get into the country in 1923 because her brother was already here. So he was the one who was vouching for them, so they would not become, as they say, a public charge. And if they had not left, in the 20s, the United States was, surprise, surprise, becoming increasingly xenophobic, nativist, isolationist, and quotas were imposed after they got here, which mm-hmm. severely restricted immigration. My grandmother had two sisters who remained in Odessa with their parents. She wrote to them again and again, pleaded with them to come here. And they demurred. They wanted to stay. It takes a lot of courage to leave knowing you will never come back. And
so you're really connecting with your past.
Yes.
Here as being a sponsor.
Yes.
Now.
Yes. And basically, you're saving someone's life. You're giving them an opportunity to find safety and refuge.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. I do want to ask a little about our visitors and the experiences they're having here in Philadelphia. I understand there might be a memory. Is there a specific memory you want to share perhaps around the Super Bowl?
So in our group, we're a welcome circle. This is under HIAS. And we, aside from providing money, we also were responsible for meeting them at the airport, orienting them to going to the supermarket, and how to ride SEPTA. So one of my roles was teaching them about public transit. And I also, because I'm the only one in the group whose parents grew up in Philadelphia, who has lived in and around Philadelphia all my life, I appointed myself the unofficial cultural ambassador to Philadelphia.
That's a big role.
So they arrived here in January of 2023, which, of course, was during the Eagles playoffs and then the Super Bowl. So one of the first English phrases that I taught them was "Go Birds," and I explained this is the universal Philadelphia greeting. You can use it; it's all purpose.
It's all true, by the way.
And then when we went on our big adventure, we rode the Broad Street Line all the way from Fern Rock down to the stadiums, walked to the stadium, came back, got out at City Hall, and we were walking down South Broad Street. And as we're walking down, there's a man walking toward us wearing Eagles gear. So I went, "Hey, go Birds!" And he says, "Hey, go Birds!" So I turn to my two Ukrainian newcomers and I go, "See, works."
Yeah, absolutely. It absolutely
And are
does.
They saying it now? Are they saying it to everyone?
Well, in fact, one of them accepted our invitation to come watch the playoff games with us.
Oh, that's great.
So we introduced him to chicken wings, cheesesteaks, and soft pretzels, which are eaten with mustard. The way they're supposed to be.
Awesome.
Well, so much more to talk about in this topic, but we thank you today for joining us, Rosalind Holtzman, who is sponsoring two Ukrainian refugees through HIAS Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for joining us on Studio 2.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Sammy Kayola, for hopping in and helping us round up some news into our Newsmaker segment. Coming up next, we're taking you down to the Jersey Shore.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. My name is Avi Wolfman-Aarons, and I'm going to start this next segment by reading you an advertisement that ran in the Inquirer this week 60 years ago, 1963. Long Beach Island, duplex seashore homes starting at $11,500. That was the price to buy a brand new house at the Jersey Shore in 1963. Now, today, that would be about $114,000. I got out my inflation calculator. And good luck buying a house at the Jersey Shore for that price, much less quadruple that price. So, big question, what is going on down the shore? This was once hailed as a summer destination for the booming middle and working class. The Jersey Shore, however, seems further and further out of reach for many in our region. So we're going to talk about it today. Why are prices rising? Should you pack up the kids and go somewhere else? Or maybe it's not as pricey as we perceive. Now, we know you've got thoughts, already got some emails coming in. So do shore summers run in your family? Where do you go? Are you looking for alternatives? Have you been priced out yourself? Share your thoughts, 888-477-9499. You can also email us at studio2@whyy.org. Got two wonderful guests for this segment. First is my colleague, Tom Grassler, who during the day is the director of WHYY's digital studios, runs that whole operation beautifully. He also, in his previous life, worked for all sorts of travel publications and is a bit of a travel nerd himself. And this whole segment was kind of birthed around the digital water cooler on Slack between me and Tom. And so we wanted to have Tom on to talk about his experiences traveling to the shore and about travel more generally. So, Tom, welcome to Studio 2.
Hey, thanks for having me, Avi.
On the line, we have Michael Bussler, who's professor of finance at Stockton University, who lives down the shore and knows the shore inside and out. Michael, welcome to Studio 2.
Well, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure to be here.
All right, so I actually want to start with you, Tom, because you've got a lot of personal history with the shore. So tell me about your family connection to the shore and your summers growing up.
Yeah, so I'm from Ben Salem, and I'm the son of two folks from Northeast Philly. My dad's from Mayfair, my mom's from Ronhurst. Big Irish Catholic family, and kind of like the typical Northeast Philly kind of adjacent shore experience where, you know, my mother was a teacher and drove a forklift, and my dad worked at a powder coating plant in Bucks County. And growing up, like at Wildwood, specifically North Wildwood, was the vacation destination. So we'd kind of do the classic Wildwood-Poconos combination that I think you find around a lot of Philadelphia. And my mom is one of eight, and all of her siblings go down the shore. They still, to this, you know, every single summer, gather them down there. And I have very fond memories growing up with all my cousins, rent one big old house, and like everybody gets a floor, every family gets a floor. And and you know, growing up, it was just common. It was expected that usually the
You're going
second
down to North Wildwood.
We're going to North Wildwood, second week of August. All the cousins are there, you know, and that was kind of. That's the type of vacation that we would take.
And then, that was affordable for your family.
Exactly. And that was kind of the thing, is that my mom, between teaching and, you know, working at a plant in Bristol and you know, my dad having a manufacturing job, it wasn't breaking the bank. It was a kind of that was a vacation we took every year in good times and in bad. Sometimes we went to Disney. I went to Disney once. I believe I was five.
Yeah.
We went to visit some relatives in London when I was in middle school. But other than that, like,
Shore.
It's the shore. It's the same three blocks in North Wildwood.
Okay, so Michael, I want to bring you into this conversation. What's your shore story? Because I know you live down there. How did you end up living down the shore, and what's your connection to the place?
Well, so I'll tell you, I was actually born in South Philly and raised in Bucks County. After I went to school and went to college at Drexel University, and lived in and around Philadelphia virtually my entire life. Many people who live in the Philadelphia area say, boy, I always wanted to go live at the shore. Mm-hmm. I'd really like to do that. So I had a chance in 1984. I was working on a project. I had a chance to come and live at the shore for a year. I thought, well, I'll get it out of my system, and then I'll come back to Pennsylvania. And that was 39 years ago. You bring up some real good points about how the prices have escalated significantly. And for the most part, many of these shore towns, maybe most of them, had primarily second homes.
Yeah.
The year-round community, the locals, were a relatively small portion, and it was really second homes that were the majority of the population. So things started to change a little bit in that, especially in the last few years, when people realized they could work remotely And if you're working remotely, they said, well, I don't have to go down the shore just in the summer. I can actually move into my second house and make that my primary residence. So in the last few years, many of the shore towns are seeing an increase in the number of year-round residents. Secondly, the people who are buying second homes seem to be very affluent, and demand really large homes, brand new homes with a lot of amenities. Yeah. And that increase in demand has driven up the price of houses at the shore. So since the houses are so expensive, when somebody owns a house that they want to rent, in order to cover that high capital cost, they're going to have to charge more for the rents. And the people that I talk to that have homes for rent, they've increased the rentals price significantly, and they're able to fill up their units. So I think it's a combination of higher real estate prices in general, and the fact that I think Americans, wherever they got all this money, Americans are coming down here and willing to spend much more for a week at the shore than they have in the past. And those things, I think, are driving up the prices significantly.
I want to bring in a caller, Jordan, who's going to echo a point that I believe you just made, Michael, about how COVID has changed the equation down the shore. So, Jordan, you're on Studio 2. What is your question or comment?
So I have been a resident of Ventnor, New Jersey for the last 7 years, a part-time resident, but did have the opportunity to live there with my family during the early days of COVID when my children were being educated virtually. And what you saw during that time was exactly what your guest referred to, which was a number of part-time residents choosing to make their second home their full-time home at the shore because of a removal of the limitations that we previously had. Many of those people, especially those with younger children, have chosen to stay, and they continue to stay now 3 years after COVID, and that has had a massive impact on the pricing, not just in my town, but in the towns surrounding us. I'm also watching a building boom. It is an era of houses that were mainly built in the 60s and before, or much newer. Those older homes are being purchased specifically for the purpose of demolishing and building these very large new homes, multiple stories, 3-4 stories, that are conforming to the regulations down there. Now, the one outstanding point is that many of these families that relocated that I know have much smaller children. And one thing that I think we all need to be aware of and discuss is the lack of a good quality public education in many of these shore towns simply doesn't exist. So I am very interested and curious to see over the next couple of years
stay.
If these families who move, if they're going to stay, and if they are, what schooling options will be available to them, and if perhaps the market will support an increased number of private schools or charter or other options.
Interesting. Well, Jordan, we got to let you go, but you bring up a lot of points there. I just want to swing it back over to Michael because we're hitting on two things right now. One is the COVID effect, but there's also, as you mentioned, Americans who somehow have a lot of money in their pockets, knocking down old homes, putting up big homes, spending quite a lot of money to do so. Are these folks the same folks that have been coming down the shore for generations? Are they coming from elsewhere? I mean, how do you explain that influx in people who have the means to do that?
Yeah, so these people, I think, are coming from all over. I think we're seeing a lot of New York people and a lot of Philadelphia people who had second homes for years. And for whatever reason, they've become much more affluent. And you're absolutely right that all of the new building that's done, or virtually all of it is done, is being built where there was a house and the house was torn down. There's no real vacant land or not much vacant land around. So these smaller houses are being torn down. I happen to live in Ventnor, and I've lived in Absecon Island here, Margate and Longport, for those 39 years. I will also say something very positive about the schools. The Margate school system, where my kids went to school, I think is very excellent. Now, after that, you have now a choice of where to go to high school, Ocean City. Before you had the choice, everybody went to Atlantic City High, and that got kind of a bad reputation for some of the problems that it had. But look, my kids went to Margate schools. All three went to Atlantic City schools. One's a lawyer and the other two are Ivy League graduates.
All right.
So they were able to get a very good education, I think, in Margate and Atlantic City. But these people are coming down. I checked the Margate enrollment numbers, and they have gone up significantly in the last 3 or 4 years.
So clearly people are testing out the idea of living around the living at the shore year-round. We'll see if they stick to it. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email us, studio2@whyy.org. We are talking with Michael Busler, professor of finance at Stockton University. We're also talking with Tom Grassler, director of WHYY's digital studios and a travel expert. Tom, I want to bring you back into the conversation here. So you're one of these families. You've been doing this for generations. There's a big pull to North Wildwood for you personally. I imagine you feel that in your heart. But this summer, you're looking at the kitchen table math, and you're just not liking what you saw. So give me a walk me through your process for deciding whether or not you wanted to take your young family down the shore this summer.
Yeah, that's a. I think you hit the nail on the head. So for a bit of context, I'm 39 years old. I was born in 1984 when our friend here was buying his first property. You know, I've got a 2 year old. He turns 2 on Saturday.
And happy birthday, by the way.
Happy birthday, little baby Theo. Shout out, baby Theo. And we have and my wife is 5 months pregnant. So we have another kid on the way. So these are certainly factors when I'm looking to, you know, I've got a kid on the way, you know, what are we going to spend our money on a vacation on? And then, as you'd mentioned, in a previous life, I worked in travel media. I worked at Time. I worked at Travel and Leisure, Food and Wine, Point Sky, Lonely Planet. So I spent most of my career as, you know, as a professional traveler. I'd be on the road for weeks at a time. I've had the privilege to be able to shoot in 32 countries. So Wildwood was kind of planted the seed in me of like, there's another life beyond the one that you can live at home, and kind of went out to find my fortunes in the world. And part of that meant that I got really good at kind of pricing things out and doing this kitchen table math that you're kind of talking about. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a little bit of a point of contention this summer when we're looking at kind of prices in Wildwood to kind of go down and meet my family. You know, we have traditionally it's this, you know, I've got it down. It's August 11th to August 19th. It's kind of that week. Usually it's around the assumption I'd always have to go to church down the shore. but I started pricing out, and I started to see that the price of Airbnbs started to look a lot like an international vacation.
Yeah.
And then I start wondering, like, what is it that I'm paying for? And there's a price, and that price is kind of social pressure. It's pressure to see, you know, my folks or my aunts and uncles, or to have my kids play with their cousins. But, you know, if we're looking at, you know, a certain price, $3,000 for a week, $4,000 for a week, kind of peak season, you know, there's a lot of other ways to spend that amount of money. You know, for $4,000, you get a vacation at Disney.
Yeah.
You know, for this year, I actually went on to Philadelphia Airport's website, and I sorted by direct flights and shortest, because, again, I have a toddler. So I found all these flights that are, you know, under 2 hours, and the one that stood out for me is Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Halifax, Nova Scotia. Wow.
So I started looking up the coast. I'm like, oh, maybe I can go to Brigantine. Maybe I can go to Ventnor. Okay, how about I started working my way up Montauk. Okay. And then I found that, you know, there's flights to Martha's Vineyard direct from Philadelphia. And then I saw Halifax. And I was
and
like,
so,
this sounds
lovely. And the end of the day, you decided to go down the shore? No.
In the end of the day, we actually picked Halifax, Nova Scotia and Cape Breton National Park over Wildwood.
For the same price.
For the same price.
Wow.
So I've got my math here, $31.76 for three economy flights direct to Halifax, Nova Scotia, a car rental, two nights at an Airbnb in Halifax itself, and then five nights at a cabin in Cape Breton National Park.
And all of that for probably less than when you would have paid just to go to drive down to North Wildwood for the week. So given that, and I want to bring in a comment here from Michelle, said, I grew up going to the shore, but I don't think my parents would be able to afford it now. Thinking about the rental fees, cost of restaurants, even a lunch sets you back. Thanks for that comment, Michelle. So given folks like Michelle and Tom's reticence to go down the shore for even a week in the summer, Michael Busler, what does the future of the shore look like? I mean, is it going to be a radically different place than it's been? Give me your crystal ball look.
Well, I think it will be different in that the higher income people will be able to afford it, and the average income earner is going to have a tougher time. Let me also say one thing. There's some ways to get around this.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because we have a comment from Dean who claims there are still affordable places at the shore. You have to know where to look. So where do you have to look, Michael Bussler?
So there are some affordable places. Brigantine, I think, is probably the most affordable of the southern New Jersey communities. But there's still some ways around it. Look, I think the New Jersey shore is probably the nicest beach of anywhere, maybe in the world. I've traveled somewhat, and I've never found a beach that is just as nice as the Jersey shore. So what a lot of people are doing is say, look, I want to spend time on the beach. I can't afford these outrageous prices. So how about if you look for a motel or something slightly offshore? You like to go to Wildwood. Well, a couple miles offshore into Rio Grande, there's some very reasonably priced motels and places to stay. So go to the shore for the day, and then instead of going to a place in Wildwood, drive over to Rio Grande, stay there, and you'll be able to get the price down significantly. I don't know how people feel about camping, but there's a
there seems to be a movement on to camp down the shore. We got the Rio Grande reroute, but Tom Grossler,
exactly.
you had something you wanted to add to this conversation as we start to wrap it up. What do you got?
So you're spot on there about being able to stay at some of these motels and be able to bring that price down. So I did a little experiment. I went on to Airbnb, and I know that true heads, you've got to know somebody and then they've got a family member, or using the same lady for a long time. But for a lot of folks, it does come down to Airbnb and Vrbo. So I set my price filter at $3,100 in Airbnb and searched a bunch of these towns and put these together. I found 11 spots in Wildwood, in North Wildwood specifically. 10 out of 11 of them are motels.
Yeah.
For that week at $3,100.
So that's going to be the option for a lot of folks, moderate income folks.
And that was the choice we made.
Yeah.
$3,100 to stay in a motel, one room, everybody in it, or for that same amount of money, go to Halifax. And then I did it up and down. I went down to Sea Isle. I found exactly one option. It was a one-bedroom studio. Went to Avalon, surprisingly. I found one option. It was a motel. Found two pretty solid options in Cape May. A lot in Brigantine. Great point. Actually, a lot in Ventnor.
Folks in Brigantine are like, please don't tell everyone about how great it is.
And some in Wildwood Crest. And it's funny to me because growing up, Wildwood Crest was for rich people. Ventnor was it was for richer folks. And Cape May especially. And I'm actually finding more affordable options in these places that I thought were kind of off limits.
So I just want to mention this real quickly before we go. Email from Jeffrey. When the National Flood Insurance Program actually collects insurance premiums consistent with the growing risk of sea level rise and climate change, the real cost will sort of bear out. And that's, we don't quite have time for that conversation today, but there is a whole nother conversation to be had about the way sort of the risks are subsidized if you build down the shore. Maybe another time. We do have to start to wrap up this conversation, though. And I want to thank Michael Bussler, professor of finance at Stockton University, who lives down the shore and knows it in and out. Michael, thanks for being on Studio 2.
Thank you. My pleasure. Look forward to doing it again.
And also talking with Tom Grossler, self-styled shore expert and a travel guru, also the director of WHYY Digital Studios. Tom, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Everyone, have a great summer wherever you're going. We'll be back soon on Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, thanks for joining us here on Studio 2. Hop Sing Laundromat is a Chinatown speakeasy, and the bartender in residence there is famed mixologist Toby Maloney. Toby just won his second James Beard Award, this one for his new book, The Bartender's Manifesto, How to Think, Drink, and Create Cocktails Like a Pro. It's co-authored by Emma Jansen. Toby Maloney dropped by recently to explain the science of good cocktails and share some drinks, by the way, with my very lucky co-host, Cherry Gregg.
Toby, welcome to Studio 2.
Cherry, thank you very much for having me. This is really exciting.
Yes, congratulations on the book. You really geeked out when it comes to cocktails in your book.
Yeah, I felt that was needed. There's a bunch of wonderful Cocktail 101 books out there, so we wanted to take it one step further.
Yeah, so you break down the mechanics of a cocktail. You get specific on everything from temperature of ice to sweeteners, bubbles, and so many other things. But I want to start by asking you, what are the basic things you need to make a pretty good cocktail?
We think of the three pillars or the three points as alcohol, strong, you know, slash strong, acid, and then sugar. And that every cocktail, be it an old fashioned or a martini or a daiquiri, all have three things that need to be in balance and in harmony to make a cocktail.
And so we know what the alcohol is, but explain the acid category. And
so
the
lemon
sugar
or lime
category.
Juice.
Okay.
Or pineapple juice or grapefruit juice or passion fruit or anything that is tart that you would think of. And then sugar is sugar, but it can be honey. It can be the sugar that's inherent in aperitifs or digestifs. It's anything that rounds things out and helps balance the cocktail.
You have some really amazing recipes in your book, and they include ingredients like rose water.
Mm-hmm.
If I have a very basic bar at home, what do I need just to be pretty good and impress some friends?
You need some sugar and some water. You need a way to press lemon and lime juice that's easy. And you need a bottle of gin, a bottle of rum, a bottle of brandy, a bottle of whiskey, maybe a couple of liqueurs like either chartreuse, if you can find it, or Saint Germain or orange curacao. And from there, you can build most things. A couple of dashes of bitters and things work, so a couple of bottles of bitters.
And so those basic things can give you at least the starting point.
Yep.
What inspires you to create a new drink?
Memories, art. Occasionally there'll be a flavor combination that I'm like, that's really interesting. I'm going to go create something that is of or pertaining to that. But more it's feelings and jokes and words and poems and things you just run into on your daily run around that you find interesting or inspiring.
Yeah. And what's sort of your favorite, I guess, alcohol to work with?
I love brandies. Everything from cognac to Slivovitz to Laird's Applejack. There's just such a wealth of diversity in brandy, and they're a little harder to find, but when you find that really cool quince brandy or the carrot brandy, it's really worthwhile.
Delicious. Sounds delicious. And since you have drinks in front of us,
ooh,
let's talk about these drinks. What do you have for us today?
The first one we're going to do is called a Jack Rose. This is a very simple cocktail. It's Laird's Applejack. Laird's is a brandy made pretty close by in New Jersey. It's the oldest family-owned distillery in the country. This is 100-proof apple brandy, some lemon, some grenadine, which grenadine is not that red stuff you see that says roses on it. Grenadine is a pomegranate syrup. And then a couple of dashes of orange bitters and a couple of dashes of Peychaud bitters.
All right. So describe the flavors that I should be expecting when I sip this.
Apples, pomegranate, lemon.
Okay. See how sophisticated my palate is.
Okay. What we're also going to do is you're going to take a sip, and then I'm going to garnish it one way. Then you're going to take another sip, and I'm going to garnish another. So take a sip of it ungarnished. We're going to talk about how aroma completely changes the game of a cocktail.
First of all, that is delicious. It's a really good drink.
Okay, now take a sip.
And let's see how it changes.
Wow.
Just a little bit of an orange rind?
A little bit of orange oil on top, yep. And now we'll do a little bit of lemon.
It's very refreshing once you put the orange lime there.
Yeah. A little orange oil, it brightens it up. Now a little bit of lemon, that brightens it up even more.
Oh, my goodness. And it's like because you can smell it, you can taste it, and it just sort of opens up your taste buds.
Exactly.
This is good. This is delicious. I see why you won the James Beard. That's a delicious drink.
Excellent. Thank you very much. It's one of my favorites. It's been around forever, and it always works on the cold days, on the warm days.
Mm-hmm.
It's three ingredients in the truth. The truth is technique, mm-hmm. and you know, you can have the most delicious alcohol, the freshest fruit, all of the best syrups, but if you don't know how to put them together and shake and stir correctly, you're going to have a poor drink.
And it has a good aftertaste, mm-hmm. too, because some drinks leave a bad aftertaste or like something when it's over, but that has a really nice aftertaste.
Thank you very much. We mm-hmm. talk a lot about the narrative arc of a mm-hmm. cocktail being from the first smell. Like when you put the glass up to your lips, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to smell the lemon or the bitters or the absinthe or whatever you have as an aromat. And then you want to pay attention to how that drink finishes and what it's like after it's not been in your mouth for a little while. So having a good narrative arc to every cocktail is something one needs to pay attention to as well.
Wonderful. And what is this one?
So this is another brandy cocktail, but this is one from New Orleans. This is called a Vieux Carré, meaning old square in French. It is from the Hotel Monte Leon. We're going to do the exact same thing. You can take a little taste, and then I'm going to garnish it two ways. So this is cognac, rye, sweet vermouth, Benedictine, Angostura, and Peychaud bitters.
That's good.
That's really
good. And it has a totally different flavor.
Totally different.
Like
vibe.
No apples, nothing. It's just totally different.
Yep.
And it's not too strong, but you can taste the strength.
Quite possibly the most important part of every cocktail is water. Mm. And making sure that you have the water content in the drink to bring it down to a point where you can really taste everything.
Yeah.
Because alcohol is too strong, lemon juice is too acidic, and tart simple syrup and most liqueurs are too sweet. You need that water to kind of temper them and stretch them out so that you can really appreciate them.
Okay. This is chemistry right here.
Sure,
I'm like, I feel like chemistry. I'm in chemistry class. Go ahead.
Okay, now we're going to do a little zoop zoop with the lemon. I'm just cutting a little piece of lemon peel with about the size of a quarter and then just squeezing it with the skin side
and it
down.
Really brightened it up a lot.
Yeah.
Just the smell of the lemon going in mm-hmm. my nostrils before taking a sip.
Totally.
Is a thing.
I mean, it's magic that aroma is invisible, but it completely changes the cocktail.
It is amazing. And I have to say, I could spend all afternoon with you. Mm-hmm. And I know people probably really enjoy sitting and allowing you to do what you do because you did not know me. You created two really great drinks that I really enjoyed. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Sherry.
And that was James Beard Award winner Toby Maloney, co-author of The Bartender's Manifesto and bartender in residence at Philadelphia's Hop Sing Laundromat. The most important ingredient is water. I'll be thinking about that for a while. Thank you to everyone today for all of the comments. I know we couldn't get to all of them. It's a hot topic, the Jersey Shore, perhaps more another day. Our producers today are Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. For more on our show, head to whyy.org/studio2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thank you for joining us, folks.
At your job, do you ever have to deal with a nose roller? How about a snub pulley? Well, if you're installing a new conveyor belt system, dealing with the different components can sound like you're speaking a foreign language. Luckily, you've got a team ready to help. Grainger's technical product specialists are fluent in maintenance, repair, and operations. So whenever you want to talk shop, just reach out. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.